Well, Andre Darlington, you have
Okay,
become
back
something of
again.
a regular on the menu. Your latest book is called Cowboy Cocktails, and we have a lot to talk about with this book. What is the
Yeehaw! Well, thank you
number?
so much for having me on.
Oh, we love talking to you. What number is this of the books? I mean, you're the most prolific cookbook writer I know.
This is 11, and crazily enough, who knew that
Oh,
when
wow.
way back when I talked to you in the beginning, that we'd still be able to do this book after book? It's amazing.
I don't know your system for it, but anyhow, you must have a really organized life agenda to be able to turn out all these books.
Well, I don't have much of a social life. Contrary to what the books might tell you, I'm not out drinking cocktails with people. But I love the research.
Uh-huh. Well, I was going to ask you, can you describe how you researched this book? I mean, I was shocked to find out we still had cowboys when we interviewed the guy who does the cookbooks with them, with the cocktail, or the cowboy cookbooks,
Yeah, he does the food.
So how did you approach doing this research?
Well, this was a really fun one for me, I think, because, we don't know that much. In the cocktail world, we have some wonderful cocktail historians, but it's a lot of emphasis on, certainly in the early days of the cocktail. The cocktail kind of exploded after the Civil War, actually. So I overlap with that era. And we know a lot about, like, sort of the fancy hotels that did the drinks. And, they kind of go, they go research the historical barman and all that. So this was really a kind of a monumental task because I did a lot of, sort of primary sources or like secondary sources that were close that would be talking about what cowboys were consuming. And I really had to dive in and figure out, I grew up with, obviously we all grew up, watching Bonanza or whatever. We think we know about cowboys. But I did a lot of research just trying to figure out what life was like, who these guys and sometimes gals were, and what would have been available to them. And
Yeah,
I had to actually
that
kind of.
was curious. How did they get all this stuff out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, it's true, and it arrived by a railroad later, but early on by ship. The gold rush really pulled a lot of good food and drink to the West Coast very early, much earlier, I think, than people realized. And when people struck gold, they wanted champagne, and they wanted fancy cocktails.
Ah, they had champagne too, yeah.
Yeah, they had champagne and brandies. I found, I kind of
Yeah,
went through a
Frank
lot of the
Brown.
brands because I wanted the book to be very, as historical as possible. It is inspired by, and I have some real historical drinks in there too, but I wanted to make sure that stuff was, legitimate to be in the book. So I was going back and, when did Jameson whiskey come to the United States? Well, really early, it turns out, like very beginning of the 19th century. So that's fair game. Some of these other things that we think, even SoCo, Southern Comfort is from the 1890s, I believe. So some of these brands went way back and they were drinking them. And sort of, it turned out that sort of New Orleans was sort of the last stop for a lot of these folks. And
Ah,
it was, of course, a great drinking town, And then
yes.
they would head out west to the frontier. Like everything in America, it's all about enterprising people. Somebody basically grabbed some booze, drove out to the trailhead, and set up a saloon. They would write saloon on the side of their wagon, and they were serving all sorts of terrible stuff, And I have some fun with that in the book. Tarantula juice, they called it, or frontier scamper juice, or and it was basically some booze, and then it was like Prohibition, it was adulterated with glycerin and molasses and tobacco, basically anything that would get you high, so it was some scary stuff. But yeah, this is one of the few books I do put a bibliography in the back. I found some wonderful books. One of them, just to mention, there's a wonderful book called Cattle Kingdom by a writer named Christopher Knowlton. I think he lives in Montana, and he sort of looks at the cowboy era from the point of view of economics and what was driving all this cattle, you know, which was really fascinating. So I just ended up getting into the mechanics of it and kind of, you know, falling in love. I read, you know, I read Blood and Thunder. I read, you know, the Owen Wister stuff. You know, I just kind of did this, you know, all-absorbing dive into cowboy world for, you know, months, basically. And bless my partner, Janine, she came along with me. We actually went down to San Antonio for it, and I did some research about the missions. You know, they're now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the Alamo is one of these missions. So I just wanted to know more about all this lore. And of course, you know, it's near where, you know, the Goodnight Loving Trail basically went through. A lot of the trails and a lot of the cows, cattle went through San Antonio. So that's kind of a – and then, of course, up to Fort Worth, you know, which is still major cowboy country. But, yeah.
It's still – cowboy culture is still going on today. Who knew?
I know. It seemed to have a resurgence in the 90s with kind of country music, but now it's really back, and there's rodeos, and country music says, you know, it kind of follows country music a little bit, I think, for pop culture in certainly in the Midwest and then the North. But, yeah, cowboy culture is huge. You know, I went down when I went to San Antonio. I had to get myself a hat. You know, I got a cowboy hat. It's a hat store that's been going since the original cowboys, since the 19th century. And, you know, you walk in there and it just smells like saddle leather and cowboys. You know, it's pretty fantastic.
What does the cowboy smell like? Perhaps you don't want to go
there.
Well,
you can imagine.
You have that, right?
Manure, you know? We'll just call it barnyardy.
Let's deal with the important stuff like this proverb, cowboy proverb, never drink unless you're alone or with somebody. I mean, who invented that sentence? It had to be Andre Darlington.
I did feel a kindred spirit there in that quote.
But
you know, it was
interesting.
Fun.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Somebody say something.
Oh, go
Hello?
Ahead.
Go ahead. All right, Andre, say something.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was interesting going down to San Antonio and getting a lot of the lore about Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who is sort of our cowboy president, and really I read his biography, which was, there's an amazing biography on him, and, a number of them, but, you know, he had lost his mother and his wife within weeks of each other, and he took off west, and people didn't know he was going to come back to politics, but he had really formative years in the west. You know, and I think he helped popularize the myth too, because he kind of went out there and lived and then came back to tell the tale. And so I follow him a bit through the book too. But there's just all these great characters. You know, we all grew up knowing about Billy the Kid, but I didn't really realize that there was all kinds of kids. There was Nevada Kid and, you know, the Silver Kid and, all, you know, went on and on and on. And they were basically these like young 19th century dandies who, you know, would basically, you know, rob people either through gambling or after they were gambling or robbing the cowboys' earnings. I think what's interesting about, you know, the cocktail has always followed money. You know, cocktails today are in cities that are doing well economically. And so I think it's fascinating the cocktail shows up at a time when, you know, the wild frontier, there was a lot of money to be made, you know, and not just in the gold rush, but in these cows, you know, all the middlemen, all the, you know, the railroad packaging and the restaurants, and people were making a lot of money along the way as this beef got, you know, sent east, first north and then basically east to the East Coast to restaurants like Delmonico's, which became famous for serving
Delmonico's
steak.
You feature that in the book. I mean, that's a legend everybody knows. Just all you did was mention it.
Helped popularize, you know, Americans basically before the Civil War, and, you know, the founding of the country is really pork and chicken, you know, but really pork. We still have the bacon and eggs for breakfast. That's from kind of that era of, you know, when settlers first came over, and that pork was the main meat staple. And the cowboys, and after the Civil War, the country had enough money and had access to these cows and had the technological wherewithal to be able to get the cows from the field to New York City. And all that kind of came together to kind of change the way Americans eat. Now, you know, Americans, you know, having a steak is such an American thing, you know, and it is all from this era. And, you know, I love a good steak and I love a good cocktail, so why not pair them up, right?
Yeah, I guess. So,
Andre, you sort of categorize drinks in different...
By technique, I think.
Different techniques or their ingredients. I mean,
he organized the book, you did it in terms of technique for, right?
I was trying to figure out how to, you know, some books I run from like light to heavy, or I don't want to do it by base spirit because then I feel like, you know, it's easier to just go to the index and find all the whiskey drinks. And that's something I've kept with. And actually I kind of stole the way I had done Batman. Batman was the first book where I was like, how am I going to categorize these drinks that are convenient, that divide up the book a little bit? Certainly between shaken, which tend to be a little bit lighter because they have citrus, and the heavier down drinks like a, you know, Negroni or an old fashioned. And so this book, I kind of did the same thing where I have sort of shaken, a built in the glass. I usually start with built in the glass. You know, it's like the low hanging fruit. You know, you don't want to shake. You don't want to get out your shaker. You don't really want to stir anything. You just put it in the glass and put it together. And it turns out there was a lot of cocktails that were like that, you know. The technique kind of runs through the book. I always want to make sure, too, with these books, that the alcohol, the liquor that I use is accessible to everybody in the United States, you know. I actually moved to North Carolina from Pennsylvania, so for whatever reason, I have a cocktail career, and I've only lived in closed states for the last decade. So, you know, we have the ABC stores, and, you know, the liquor is limited, and people drive to the border to get liquor anyway.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure that people have access to it. And I also want to make sure that if it's somebody's first cocktail book, that I have all the technique that they would need in there. Obviously, you can go out to YouTube these days and get all kinds of information. But I want to make sure that they have some basics and in writing, you know, so that people know how to, you know, what's going on behind the bar.
So, I mean, I wonder how you know did you actually mingle with cowboys in your research?
You know, I did a lot of research, you know, mostly through stuff like Texas Monthly. There's a magazine called Cowboys and Indians. you know, I grew up in – it was funny enough that I grew up in Iowa, which was just south enough that a kid in my class was this, like, young rodeo star. And so I kind of – you know, it's not like I was raised in any kind of cowboy culture. In fact, when we were doing the book, I thought, you know, you don't have to put my name on the front cover. I'm not sure how cowboys with an Andre with an accent de goo will go over in Dallas. You know, who's this French guy?
funny.
you know, so I'm not going to complain, you know, claim that I'm a real cowboy, although I've done field work and I've worn cowboy boots. So maybe that's. But, you know, I'm no horse wrestler, that's for sure. But, yeah, there's a lot of it was just – and, you know, I really wanted to get through sort of the mystique of the cowboy to get to what they were really like. And I found out some fascinating stuff, such as many, many, many of them were ex-servicemen from the Civil War. They were often, Southerners, you know, after – after the war was over, they sort of didn't really know what to do with themselves. That happened on both sides. But in the South was devastated economically. And so these guys went West, you know, and they kept their role that, you know, that each of the soldiers was basically given, you know, a rucksack with their bedroll. And they took those and they brought, a lot of the times they brought their rifles with them. Because a lot of them fought with their own rifles in the beginning anyway, in the South. And so they took that with them. And then, you know, the chuck wagon that we think about was a converted Studebaker that had been used, you know, during the war to move stuff around. And so those kind of iconic images of the cowboy, you know, a lot of it is coming from after this Civil War, which is still very real to these guys. And, you know, the other thing that was interesting was just how much Spanish influence. I have a page in there about all the words that have come into English from the, you know, basically the Spanish, you know, were down on that in those borderlands, you know, long before the English came. And so, yeah. You know, words like lasso and buckaroo and all these have these Spanish origins. So that was fascinating as well. It was fascinating to find out that, you know, the cowboys were drinking mezcal, basically, on the border there. You know, mezcal and tequila, what became tequila. Uh-huh. So that was interesting, too. So less modern stuff and more just really a deep dive into figuring out who these guys were, you know, that were out there.
Yeah, the thing that amazes me is that the culture involves a type of person who's extremely
yes.
courteous, for example. I mean, old-fashioned courteous even, if you know what
yeah,
I mean.
There were, yeah, I think that comes a lot of these kind of, you know, they were soldiers, and they also kind of had a, you know, it was pretty lawless out there, so your behavior was important and studied very closely, you know, by people. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of having manners meant that, you know, if you're meeting somebody out in the wild and they have good manners, they're probably not going to kill you. Never know. The kids
right.
would, you know, these dandies would. But, you know, there was a lot of just you had to have an ethical code because there was no government to come in and help, you know. It was like
right.
they really did a lot of self-policing. And it, what's funny is how many of these cowboys then became, you know, lawmen. And it was basically like, well, he's a really good person and a really good shot, so let's put a star on him, you know. And some of them were really great at it, and some of it, you know, sometimes it was lethal. You know, I don't know that, for instance, Bill Hickok, you know, I'm not sure that he really wanted to be the sheriff, although he did take a certain relish in killing people. But
now,
yeah,
where
absolutely,
there's
a real code.
Where did the names, I think that, it's just wonderful read to go through the names of these cocktails. I mean, mention some of them.
I had a really fun time with the names, and basically,
you
while
made
I was
them
reading,
up.
Yeah, I made them up, and while I was
yeah, Peter
reading
said
all of
you
these
had
cowboy
yeah.
books. Yeah, when I was reading all these cowboy books, I would just see a phrase and I'd circle it, and then I'd write it down on a list, and you know, be like, oh, that's fun, like. There's a book where they talk about bellying through the bush all the time, which meant running away from the law, right? Because you've done something bad in town, and now you're bellying through the bush. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I came back to it, and I was like, bellying through the bush, let's make that something muddled, you know? Let's make it, you know? And so I just found the vocabulary of the cowboys is so much fun, you know, too. These were just, like, tough people. And some of them weren't particularly literate, but there's this sort of, like, beauty to, you know, they would call, you know, cemeteries that were bone orchards, you know, and that's
yeah.
just what they called them, you know. And I'm like, that's such a vivid, you know, it's such
it
a
is.
Vivid thing. And the cowboys have this, like, really wry and dry sense of humor, you know, kind of, I guess, kind of like military dudes, you know, if you've, you know, you talk to Vietnam vets, which I did. I worked in a hospital for a while in a vet hospital, and you know, it's that kind of same kind of like gallows humor, you know, death is right around the corner all the time, so you're going to be kind of funny about it.
Well, I mean, just mention some of these names. I mean, like Tombstone Tonsil Painter. You made that up.
Well, tonsil paint was a word for strong liquor, so some of these you know, like Frontier Scamper Juice, that was just a nickname for the really bad uh-huh. rot gut stuff. So I thought, well, that's too fun of a name to pass up. And so I kind of redo, you know, I make like a more delicious, an actually delicious version of what they were doing, which is, you know, you can get tobacco bitters and some molasses and kind of mix up some stuff. And it's actually really fascinating how some of the drinks in this book, they do just taste old. They're sort of, I kind of went back to like the oldest cocktails, you know, tending to be fairly simple, although, you know, I get to the point, one of my favorite drinks in here is the 30 shots in 30 seconds, which is references the OK Corral, and the legend was that these, you know, men all, there was 30 shots went off in 30 seconds. So I actually went back into the historical record and was like, is this possible? And I sort of put that in the head note. But then I do this beautiful divided cocktail that kind of settles out between the different colors, kind of like a, you know, we had the Pousse Café way back in the day. People drank Pousse Café.
Yeah, right. I never could make that work, but.
Yeah, I know, it's hard. This one actually works because I only do three colors, so it does kind of divide out. But you know, they love stuff like this. There's a part of the cowboys that I think people miss, that they were, you know, a lot of times these were young men coming out of the war at the end, and there's a certain childishness to them, right? So here they were, this poor Southern kid. They got drafted, or they, you know, fought with their family in the Civil War, and then all of a sudden they go and do this thing, and they make big bucks. And so you're like, what would kind of like a 18, 19-year-old boy do with big bucks? Well, he's going to eat oysters. He's going to try champagne for the first time. They love maraschino cherries. I think we think of this cowboy.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that this is a period when that was introduced in the States,
yep.
Maraschino cherries. I think they're made of plastic, by the way. They're not really maraschino cherries.
Right,
you know,
right.
The things you buy, yeah. So, that's when that came into vogue.
Yeah, and so it was fun to go back and realize that, you know, out on the range, there was no sugar usually. There were no eggs unless they found them on the trail. And there was, you know, no fresh fruit, so they ate wild onions for vitamin C. And so when they went into town, they were after, you know, gambling, drink, and food.
Women.
You know, they were really food motivated, and they were really sugar motivated. So if they could find a hotel and there was apple pie that had sugar in it, boy, I mean, they would eat the place clean, you know. So it's the same in cocktails. The cocktails tended, the stuff that they liked were sweet, you know. And I think we think that's funny, you know, because we think cowboys, manly, you're just drinking whiskey neat. And it's like, no, sugar was highly rare and expensive and valuable. So when they had the money, they were basically, you know, having sundaes, you know.
So what sticks in your mind, Rabbit? That you...
I just turned to Deadwood Dick.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he loved that one, Deadwood Dick.
That is so
That's
much
like
fun.
That's like Spotted Dick. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the Deadwood Dick was so much fun because that guy, and that he was world famous, and that drink ends up in the Savoy Cocktail Book, you know, probably the most important cocktail book ever written, really, because it came out right after Prohibition over here, but it came out in London. So that Deadwood Dick mythology went all the way to London and got recorded over there. And when you read the recipe, you know, after reading a lot of these early recipes, I thought, it is from the frontier. It totally could be from the frontier. It's what they were drinking. It's what they liked. And I found that fascinating that it had made it that far, you know, and that's a testament to really cocktails go around the world. You know, we all drink Mai Tais, you know, we drink all kinds of stuff that's, you know, from the other side of the world sometimes. And I thought that was really great mythology and wonderful truths about cocktails, that they followed these famous people and somehow they got it, you know, the drink got attached to their name. And maybe it was true that it came from there and who knows? So that's a fun one.
Now, why Old Tom Gin? You're very specific in some cases about a particular supplier, but the Deadwood Dick has Old Tom Gin. Now, what makes Old Tom so special?
So Old Tom appears. So Geneva is the first gin. It's actually more of a brandy. It's sort of a burned wine. You know, they call it. And then Old Tom comes out at a very specific time, sort of like early 19th century, mid-19th century. And that Old Tom style would have gone, you know, certainly to the gold rush. And then London Dry doesn't really come into the U.S. until later. So there would have been a mix of even Geneva and Old Toms. And so there's a bunch of styles of gin working out in the West. And then, of course, London Dry sort of took over, and the other, you know, certainly an American palate, the other two dropped out. And what's been interesting with the craft cocktail revolution is that Old Tom is sort of back, I think it's in, you know, Martini, you know, some of the early Martini variations call for Old Tom. And for people that don't know, Old Tom is, it tends to have a little bit of sugar in there. So it's like a gin, but it's sweet. And it just lost out to the London dry style eventually at some point in the late 19th century.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Did you have something about Southern Comfort in there too?
Yeah, I do a fun coffee drink with a Southern Comfort whipped cream. Southern Comfort is comes, you know, it appears in New Orleans, I think, in 1890. So this towards the end of the cowboy era. The cowboy era really goes from the Civil War, the end of the Civil War, really up to like 1893, technically, or something like that. There was a couple of economic crashes. The price of beef crashed. There was bad weather, repeatedly bad weather where they lost herds. And sort of the magic was sort of gone. And also, so many settlers had come west during that 30-year period that the frontier got cordoned off, and there was barbed wire running across that whole running across the plains.
Right, yeah.
And they really couldn't run the cattle from south to north the way that they had. So the era kind of came to an end.
Now let's make sure we understand all of the resources that are available in your wonderful book, because it's not just about drink. You've got all kinds of food characteristics in there.
Yeah, I love the food for this book. I try to add a few snacks and foods to all of my cocktail books just so people have something. And here it really kind of sets the mood and the scene. And I have to say, I had as much fun doing these recipes as I ever have in any of my books. And they were the recipes like the ranch beans, which I went back to some really old sources, which are funny. You know, the old sources on cowboy food, of course, is just, you know, the ingredients. There's no 4 tablespoons of this and that. It's like, you know, handful of beans, lard, throw it together.
It's like, you know, my family recipes.
exactly. They're like very old school recipes. But, you know, I found some of them, and the ranch beans, and they are amazing. Ox eyes, you know, which is, you know, is sort of eggs in purgatory type food. They ate that, and that probably comes from Spanish cuisine that they were getting up from, coming up from Mexico. I didn't really realize how much macaroni they ate. I sort of, you know, in Americana, it's sort of like a hamburger helper, right? The whole country has eaten macaroni and beef at some point. But it turns out it's really, really old, and that dried macaroni made it out west in the 19th century, and that was fun. And another fascinating one that's in there is the jerky gravy, where you literally take beef jerky and pound it out.
Yeah.
This is a very legit old way of doing things, and they would carry jerky with them, and they would pound it and make it and, you know, reconstitute it and make it into a gravy. And it turns out that I was very skeptical, as one might be, of this, but it's
delicious.
Yeah, I wish
I.
Really delicious.
I just got another one. Chili steaks, but it's called, this little sidebar is called Free Lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Tell our listeners about Free Lunch. Miss Ann already is lined up for this one.
So the Free Lunch was sort of like, you know, if you go to Spain today and you order, or Italy, and you go and get a cocktail, they'll give you a little olives, or they'll give you a little something, little maybe sometimes even a sandwich. And this is how it was in the United States, too. And the bars would basically put out what they called a free lunch. You basically had, you know, you ordered a drink, and then they put out these little snacks for you. And it was like smoked oysters and crackers, and they loved Limburger cheese, probably because, you know, Limburger doesn't go bad, right? It's already bad. And, you know, so these kind of things that could make it. The salted peanuts were really popular, you know, kind of cold. Some pretzels,
well, that's
pickles.
The, you get all that salt, then you want to drink more.
Exactly.
It's interesting. It occurs to me to wonder what the connection is between what you're suggesting in your book and what Australian equivalent of cowboys ate every day, called the counter lunch.
Right. Yeah.
And
it's very similar.
You would go into the counter and have a counter lunch. The one thing that was pretty clear was women were not allowed
right.
to have the counter lunch. It was obviously much more sophisticated than they managed.
Yeah, well, I think it's very similar. It comes from the old country. You know, it came from the old country where, you know, bars, you know, even London bars would put out food. It depend on the style of the bar, but I think you're absolutely right. It was sort of these snacks that were just coming along with the food, and obviously salty, and then you drink more.
Yeah,
we just interviewed them, Diane Kouchalis, about Greek culture, and I remember the first time I was in Greece being shocked that you never got served a drink without food that came along
right.
with it.
I mean, it's a
whole different mentality.
I was in Athens last year or the year before, you know, and I got a cocktail and I got these like baba beans, you know, came with it. Like, oh, this is spectacular.
No, are there still areas of this cowboy culture cocktail and the accompanying snacks that you still are curious about? Unresolved questions.
You know, it opened as many questions as it closed. I mean, one of the big questions was, you know, we have a lot of, there's just more historical record on the East Coast, right? I mean, you kind of know what was happening in New York when it was happening. The West Coast is a little bit fuzzier to figure out, you know, like for my other books, you know, I wanted to find out how did Pisco come up to San Francisco, you know, and it came up on these boats at a specific time, but and then kind of spread across the country. There's no Pisco in this book, but that kind of thing. I think finding out that there was that much good liquor on the West Coast was really shocking to me. And I would love to know more about, you know, dig deeper into San Francisco and figure out, you know, where this liquor went, you know, because basically it went to the gold rush in the 1850s. You've got good, fancy, quote unquote, fancy drinks for the gold rush in 1850s. By the 1860s, it's reached sort of like it's crossed the Rockies. And it was like, okay, so by the 1860s, we're really in, you know, we've got fancy liquor. And then, of course, the trailheads for the railroads start reaching in.
Then,
boom, by the 1870s, 80s, you know, you have fancy drink everywhere. And so there's always, you know, it's wide open country out there. And I feel like every time, you know, I learned so much going to San Antonio, and that's just one city. You know, I'd love to do more research.
Oh, yeah, I think San Antonio is amazing in terms of what you don't know. You don't even realize you don't know. Yeah,
they have this whole regional history that it's so, you just don't know it if you're not from there, you know. And so I'd love to do some of the more frontier towns and, you know, see if there's an archive, you know, something like Oglala, which, you know, was this crazy. You know, these towns, the other issue, I think, was these towns would boom to the point that they maybe would, you know, have some kind of print circular or some historical record or that, and then they would collapse, you know, because of the economic upheavals. So, you know, it's like these, you know, so it's like not only you're looking for a needle in a haystack, but the haystack only lasted for like 10 years, you know? So, in the, you know, 10 years, 200 years ago. So it's like or 100, you know, at least 100 years ago, and so it's a lot to dig up. But you know, there are a lot of good books on the history of the cowboys, and they mention, you know, I was sort of combing through them, and sort of for any mention of sort of the culture and the food and what was going on, and then I'd try to research that, you know. So it was kind of a just down the rabbit hole on this one. But these are the type of books that I love to write because they're fun, but they're also really informative. And, you know, I didn't come away, I had preconceived notions about, you know, when they asked me to do the cowboy cocktail stuff, I was like, oh, it's just going to all be inspired because there wasn't that much going on, you know, that's what I think everybody thinks. And doing this book sort of changed my thought on that completely. And I hope that it'll change people when they read the book too.
That's somehow or other. This is Anne. Maybe you remember. Maybe I'm just remembering. There was controversy over a drink called a Gibson.
Oh yeah.
And I drank Gibsons for a while, but just give our listeners an idea of what makes a Gibson so different.
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, the Gibson is certainly the cocktail onion. And, you know, it's one of my favorite drinks, and it's savory. And I love the savory drinks. I think, you know, savory drinks are popular in the U.S. now, but it took a very long time. And I remember going to Italy, you know, a number of years ago, and you get a Negroni, and it comes with olives in it. And I thought, it's so brilliant, you know. It is delicious, actually.
Is it good?
I know, it sounds bad. It sounds bad, but it really works. Maybe anything works when you're staring at the ruins of Hadrian's Wall. But you know, it is or not Hadrian's Wall, but the Colosseum, whatever the wall is there. There's a great bar next to the wall.
Any wall.
Any ancient wall will do.
Well, all right. So we're at this point again. I always love talking to you, and I never feel bad about saying goodbye because I always know there will be another book.
Yes.
And then you'll be back, and we'll be talking again.
Are you working on your
next book already?
Yeah, the next book, I'm having another crazy year where I have two books coming out this year, both of them in spring. It's just how it shook out. I wrote them at different times, and it's just sometimes how the releases work. The other one is called Forbidden Cocktails, and it is all pre-code. So Hollywood pre-code from 1930 to 1934, the drinks from the films and the drinks inspired by the actresses and actors of the films and that kind of stuff. That's another one with TCM, Turner Classic Movies. So I'm really excited by that one. That one was as big or even bigger, deeper dive. I somehow ended up with these two projects because I couldn't say no to them because they were so fascinating. And then I was just buried in research for like 2 years.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
But luckily they were very different. The Cowboys and Hollywood Pre-Code, they have a little overlap, of course. And, you know, John Wayne appears in Pre-Code. That's a really fun one. It comes out May 7th. So I'm doing a tour. Both of these are going to get a little tour. I think I'm going to be on the West Coast for Cowboys, obviously, out Dallas way in Los Angeles. And then the Pre-Code book gets a launch in New York.
Well, don't forget to say hello to John Wayne at the airport in Orange County, California.
Absolutely. I actually love that airport.
and he is one tall dude. Huh?
He is one tall dude, that is for sure. 6'3" or 4", yeah, something like that.
This is off topic, but, you know, we keep running into this Humana stuff, you know, where, what's it called, Rabbit? You know, where they march the cattle in Europe from the mountains.
Yeah, I can't. It's
Humanesco.
It just left my frontal brain.
That culture went so far where, you know, they'd walk the animals down from the mountains into the southern warmer climes. They even developed their own language. I mean, you ought to get into that one first.
Wild. Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, that is wild.
It was the transhuman, I think.
Transhumana, right, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Look that up. Check that
out.
Andre, you're going to be fascinated about that because they were gone for so long they even had their own language. So,
well, that's my next cocktail book, obviously.
Love talking to you, Andre, and
Thank you so much for having me with
Cowboy Cocktails. Listeners, every book he writes is a delight, but this one's really fun. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Yes, we're talking, listeners, to Evan Dorman. It's interesting spelling, Evan. Is it like close to original German spelling?
Yeah, that's my understanding. You got it 100% correct.
Interesting. Yeah. Anyhow, he comes from a really good company, an award-winning company, and they have an outstanding product called Steeped Coffee is the name of the company, and there are various products springing from that. Evan, if those, because we've interviewed Steeped Coffee before, for those, though, that don't know anything about the company, could you just do a little elevator sketch about what the company is about?
You bet. It's my pleasure. So Steeped Coffee was founded in 2016 by Josh Wilbur. The inspiration for our product stemmed from a really common problem that a lot of us have, which is how do we enjoy delicious coffee on the go? Josh is a self-proclaimed coffee snob, and he wanted to enjoy specialty coffee while traveling without having to lug around all the equipment that one would need to make a delicious cup of coffee. So he tried to create a really simple solution. He made hundreds of different prototypes and created the Steeped Brew Bag. So we brew coffee similar to how most of us are familiar with brewing tea. We made a fully compostable package, and we combine that with ultra-premium coffee to make brewing really delicious coffee on the go, as simple as brewing a cup of tea. And since that day, Steeped has been on a mission to really try to shake up the coffee industry. We are the intersection of quality relative to high-quality coffee and high standards for manufacturing, convenience in terms of creating a way to brew coffee that's really simple, and also sustainability. Our brew bag is sourced from 100% plant-based materials that are fully compostable, not only the bag itself, but the outer package and the boxes that we ship in. We make our own products under the Steeped brand, and we license our brew bag and packaging to more than 300 coffee roasters around the country and some international customers. And our vision is to be accepted as a great way to brew coffee by anyone and everyone. We create a lot of value for people who are on the go. We have a lot of business in the hotel space. Our brew bags are used in a lot of luxury and premium hotels. And we are working to try to create more opportunities for people to enjoy the Steeped brew method in offices, on airlines, cruise ships, pretty much anywhere that people are accustomed to traveling these days.
You know, what I don't understand is why nobody else thought of it first. You're not going to tell us what the secret is. I know that.
Yeah, there were a few companies that tried, but not from a premium perspective. A lot of stuff has happened in coffee over the last couple decades, this premiumization of the industry, where roasters are getting super high focused on sourcing only the highest quality coffee from growers around the world. And as that business has grown, Josh saw that this was a great idea to try to revive what was kind of a concept that was started by companies that make a lot of instant coffee and hadn't really focused on this more premium consumer segment. So that's really kind of the impetus for what was created a few years back.
Well, now you've won a great number of awards, which is, like, I guess why we originally got in touch with you. So you have an outstanding product and business model both, right?
That's correct. So we have won a lot of awards for our packaging. Most recently, this last December, we were honored on Inc.'s 2023 Best in Business list. We are a certified B Corporation and Benefit Corporation, and we were really excited to be part of this list that recognized 215 groundbreaking companies that focus on purpose before profits to try to make a difference in their communities, industries, and the world at large. We were selected from a really competitive pool, and we were chosen because of our achievements relative to packaging and environmental stewardship, which is how we earned a place on that exclusive list. And It was a real incredible honor. It really validates our efforts in transforming the coffee industry through eco-friendly practices, and it's a real motivator for us to continue driving innovation for a more green future.
No, go ahead, Robert.
One of them is the method of
I can't brewing. Hear you, Robert.
One of them is the method of brewing.
You're not talking into the telephone.
The other is the quality of the coffee.
Can you hear him, Evan?
No, I can't.
No. He's not online or something. I don't know what that is, because I can't hear him either. We cannot hear you, Robert. Edmund, I understand through your publicist that this is not a static company. Do you have a whole big R&D? Because you seem to already have the answer. So, what do you research and develop, and how do you change and find new trends and directions?
Well, we're looking, again, just to kind of lean into that strength that we've identified in terms of trying to make really great coffee convenient. We're always trying to make our existing product easy to use for consumers. And then we have a lot of different ideas in our innovation pipeline that will help different coffee companies and businesses that are in the business of providing great coffee to customers really easy. So, really for this next year, a lot of what we're focusing on is just expanding our partnerships with roasters and trying to create more awareness around our brew bag. But in the coming years, we do want to continue to innovate and utilize really high quality packaging that is compostable to try to make coffee and cold coffee more accessible to more people. There's been a lot of interest around cold coffee consumption in recent years, and so a lot of our future innovation is going to be focused on not only hot coffee, but also trying to make cold coffee more accessible.
You mean like cold brewed? Or
exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. A lot of statistics suggest that more than 70% of consumers, especially those in younger demographics like Gen Z and millennial consumers, opt towards a cold beverage when they visit cafes. So that's definitely going to be a part of our innovation pipeline as we continue to focus on hot beverage consumption as well.
Yeah, and our local trendy coffee shops, it's a small chain. They do a huge business in cold brew. In fact, I order cold brew most of the time.
Sure.
So, your business structure, what determined how you're going to set up corporately wise?
What determined our interest in being a certified B Corporation, or what aspects of the business structure? Well, our focus on purpose before profits is really, again, inspired by our founder, Josh Wilbur. He believes in not only trying to create a viable company that can create jobs for people and help create really great opportunities for people who are focused on sourcing great coffee, but wants to figure out as well opportunities for the organization to give back. So just trying to look at how we can make a positive impact in every aspect of what we do as it relates to business.
Yeah. We can't hear you, Rabbit. I'm telling you. He wanted to know about how you match up to some established places, businesses like Starbucks.
Well, Starbucks is a great supplier of coffee, and they have a lot of cafes. We're focused on a specific brew method. We look up to businesses like Keurig. So Keurig was a company that created a really great capsule and a system in terms of equipment as a way to brew coffee and share it with people. That's really a good model for how you can conceptualize who we are and what we do. Again, we're focused on creating a brew method above and beyond anything else. So our goal in time would be to partner with companies like Starbucks, and to be able to license our brew bag technology to them. So we hope companies like Starbucks will be a customer of ours in the future.
I see.
But we don't necessarily try to compete in terms of creating our own brand or family of products. That's a real kind of distinguishing factor that differentiates our business model from other coffee companies.
Why doesn't somebody steal it?
Which of the parts of the world that you think...
Robert, you're talking, but nobody can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
My question's hanging there, since I think Peter's having some technical difficulties here. So why doesn't anybody steal your process?
Well, we have... we're patent pending, so we're taking action to try to protect. We have competitors in the field, and we certainly do believe that a high tide will raise all ships, so we welcome competition. There are a few companies out there. Steep was kind of the first to move into this space from a premium perspective, and there are a handful of companies out there creating similar products. We believe that we're doing it with higher quality standards, and our commitment to compostability is a big component of our value proposition. So there certainly is competition in the marketplace, and our focus is relative to just trying to figure out how we can do a better job of creating Steeped as a better version of itself and creating better experiences on behalf of our customers. And that's we believe will be critical to our success.
Yeah, those little things are a nuisance, by the way, those little cups. And what to do with them is the next thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Boy, if they can ban plastic bags, I mean, you could imagine they could ban those things pretty quickly too.
Sure.
Is there any way you could step into, out of, or further into the coffee industry? I mean, it's a pretty well set. What you're doing is what you're doing.
Well, definitely just continuing to grow and popularize this brew method. We feel like we have a long road to go. Most consumers are still unfamiliar with seeing coffee presented this way. So until, we get to the point where you see this brew method represented on every grocery store shelf featuring, different coffee roasters from around the country, we feel like we have a long path to go, even just with this specific product. So just continuing to improve product quality and get more people to adopt this method so that people are familiar with it and regard it as a great way to brew coffee, that's going to take a long time. And our goal is
because they have to get past the idea that I had, this concept of instant coffee.
Yep.
And many
people are surprised when they taste it for the first time that it can taste really good. And so,
yeah, I was. I was shocked. I mean, I didn't want to taste it at all.
Yeah, it's a fun part about what we do is just being able to open people's minds toward really helping them understand how easy making a great cup of coffee can be.
Well, I put it to the great test as I exposed our coffee snob son to it, and he approved it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and he would be the age group that you'd be aiming for anyhow, And, I think back as a friend of ours, her family way back when, came out with the first instant coffee that you could buy. I can't remember the name of it. The company took over the whole field eventually. But it stopped them, and there was no place further to go.
Yeah.
So, how do you get around that?
Get around which specifically? I'm sorry.
Once you get around the fact that there was no further development of the product possible.
We are looking
if you've reached your goal.
Oh, we haven't. We're not even close to reaching our goal. I mean, we want to continue. We have so much road to travel in terms of what we can do just with this specific product. And then our goal next year and years beyond would be to innovate our product pipeline and continue to come out with additional products that provide similar experiences for people in different environments. Coffee is a beverage that's consumed in so many different places for so many different occasions. In so many different volumes, and so
I'm not sure I understand that altogether. Could you give me an example of like?
Okay. Of course, yeah. So making it easy for people to brew fresh coffee in restaurants, to making large banquets and hotel catering more convenient. That there's an opportunity there for both hot and cold consumption. A lot of the packaging and methods that people utilize are things that were innovated many, many years ago, and they use materials that are not of high quality, coffee itself that's of lower quality. So being able to innovate by bringing higher quality materials that are less wasteful and also higher quality coffee products, those will be real big opportunities for us. Coffee is a commodity, but it's graded on a 100-point rating system. People have to go and undertake a lot of education to be certified as a quality grader in the coffee industry. One might think would be a really subjective process of, you know, one person scoring a coffee really high and another scoring it low is actually not subjective at all. It's very objective. People go through rigorous training. Once they obtain the certification for grading coffee, they have to have their palate recalibrated every few years, go through a process of recalibration.
Really?
So that's done to essentially...
It's worse than those wine courses.
Exactly,
The sommelier courses are terrible.
Yeah, and wine is actually the second most complex beverage that we ingest. Coffee actually has even more flavor compounds compared to wine. It's the most complex beverage that we taste. And so there's a lot that goes into scoring coffee, which ultimately affects the price of the coffee. So where coffee as a commodity might be traded for somewhere between $1.50 to $2 per pound, in the premium industry, roasters are willing to pay multiples of that price to get their hands on product that is the best of the best, so to speak. So we're really focused on kind of that higher quality and more premium segment as a way to be able to reach more customers. And so through our technology and through our innovation pipeline down the road, by virtue of combining less waste, which is an initiative that a lot of businesses are undertaking in order to try to reduce the use of plastic, and then also combining that with higher quality coffee, we feel like we can create a compelling offering in areas where currently there's not a lot of opportunity or access to high quality coffee. So I mentioned hotels and restaurants, but you could also think about, you know, all the tens of thousands of office spaces that exist all over the country, and an opportunity to improve the quality of experience that employees are receiving on a daily basis relative to what they're used to drinking.
Right. Now, if made everyone want some, how do they get it? I said we made everybody want to get some, so how do they get it?
Our coffee is available on steepedcoffee.com, and we also have links to a lot of our partners' coffees, because, again, we license our brew method for about 300 coffee roasters around the country. So if you go to our website, you can not only shop our coffees, but then you can click on a tab that says partners, and that'll take you to online shopping carts for a lot of our trade partners. As well, so many people shop from Amazon these days, and Amazon is a resource to be able to purchase our coffee.
Well, for everything, I guess.
Get it delivered.
Everything goes to Amazon.
Exactly. And then hopefully over time we'll be popping up on grocery store shelves near everybody. Again, our vision is we want to get it to a place where people walk into a grocery store and just like that ubiquitous pod and capsule set that one would see in on the coffee aisle, we'd love to see a steep brew bag set right next to that pod and capsule set and a lot of different coffee companies featured in our brew method. That's our long-term vision. It might take us about 5 to 10 years to get there. So in the meantime, just please check us out online at steepedcoffee.com. Feel free to shop our coffees and definitely try the coffees from a lot of our trade partners. That's most of what we do. is licensing our brew method to other companies. So again, we have our own product family to try to popularize the method. We're super proud of our partnerships and all of the different great coffee options that our partners are featuring.
Well, I'm so glad I got to, you've opened my horizon altogether with, I loved your product. And I admired your company, but you've expanded the whole future development for me or my vision of it, and I thank you for that.
Yeah, that really means a lot.
Oh, and listeners, it's Steeped, STEEPED coffee, and believe me, you're going to be grateful that you heard about it. Let's put it that way, Evan Doman. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you. Can you stop the recording?